the other day. I opened and read it and heard that. Man's the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way. A letter from the government the other day. I opened and read it and heard that. Man's the way that I live, no concern that. Man, we don't have to settle this another way.
Movement, music, move into it. Put a fist up, prove it to us. This is much more than music to us. This is beauty and strength.
Good morning. You're listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio, WPWC. Good to be with you again this week. My name is Naveed Nasser, and with me today, as always, is my co-host, Salman Kamishong. Salman, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Yes, I am.
Excellent, excellent. Now, today we have two topics on the table, and the first topic that we're going to be talking about is the NATO summit in Chicago. And we had a guest lined up today, and unfortunately he can't be here with us.
He's actually, we call him now. I think he should be all set.
He should be all set?
Just got a text from him, yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll try to get him on the line. In the meantime, so what we're talking about here is the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which was basically started in the 40s, in the aftermath of World War II, as a military alliance by the Western powers that, in conjunction with the Soviet Union, had successfully defeated the Axis, Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan in World War II, and it was a way to basically, it was a competing imperial coalition in opposition to the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact, which was the coalition that the Soviet Union and its allies had drawn up. We've seen this over and over again over the course of history, where competing interests and competing powers do this sort of thing, basically draw a line on the map and unfortunately, it also appears that we are not getting through to Larry. More than likely, he's not going to be joining us today. But we can still talk about NATO ourselves and a little bit about the summit that happened in Chicago last week. So, yeah, let's get started. NATO. We already talked about this with regards to Libya, and with regards to a little bit with we touched on this with when Abiyomi was here from Pan African Newswire, with regards to Syria and with regards to some of the other stuff that's happening around the globe. Basically, NATO functions as the military wing of the U.S. It's a military projection of U.S. imperialism without actually circumventing the whole nasty business of the U.S. declaring war, the U.S. itself going to war. And I know people who draw some sort of fine line and distinction between the U.S. on the one hand and NATO on the other. So, what do you think, Salman? Salman? Okay, that's interesting. Salman, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, we're having a little some technical issues here, but let's just get your take on what went on at the NATO summit and also about NATO in general.
Yeah, well, I mean, when I think of NATO, I think of imperialism. You know, I just wanted to like start from that point of departure, is that often folks, the common narrative is that, because most people are not knowledgeable in terms of the background of NATO, what they do and how they operate. But, a very recent example of NATO, I mean, I think of Libya. I think of NATO's involvement in Libya in their bombing, and going along with the U.S., the U.S. is, narrative and request, to bomb that North African nation. I think of NATO being involved in Iraq and Afghanistan, and sending in troops there and being involved in the devastation and loss of life and the carnage that has been, you know, has been caused in those regions as well. And so when we look at NATO and this meeting coming to to Chicago and as it was, you know, last week, you know, I'm in solidarity with all those people that got out that were protesting and protesting NATO. And you look at NATO at Navid, as you know, this NATO meeting, it almost is like the elitist G8 meetings, you know, where you look at the people that are excluded and the voices and the perspectives that are excluded. Did this NATO meeting include, you know, the many, you know, Afghan voices that protest, you know, their country being occupied? No, they didn't, you know. And so those are my initial, you know, instinctive, you know, reactions, you know, to your question in terms of this topic of NATO that we're discussing today.
Yeah, I actually do know people who went to Chicago for the NATO summit, and it's With the whole protest movement that was happening around NATO, there is like kind of like a I don't know, I don't want to degrade or downgrade anyone's anything, but it's one thing to protest against NATO itself as an organization, or war, or imperialism in the generic, not in the generic, but in a broad what's the word, like theoretical way, right? But it's also important that when things go down and when military organizations, military coalitions like this get involved, that people protest their actions as they're happening. And as much as it was great to see all those people out on the streets of Chicago, it would also have been wonderful to see them protesting out on the streets protesting what was going on in Libya last year.
That's right.
For example.
Right.
Oh, and good news. It looks like we do have Larry on the line. Larry, you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Excellent, excellent. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself? First of all, introduce yourself, and then talk to us about the summit in Chicago a little bit.
Sure. I'm a writer and an activist. I've been an activist, actually, going back 20 years. When I was 15 is when I first started in the black community. But I, you know, I got away from it for a while, and I started becoming more active after the 9/11 in response to a lot of the Muslim and Arab bashing, the racism that was going on. And since then, I've been able to travel to Palestine, Cuba, Venezuela. I was actually in Libya, Bangladesh, and Palestine to work. In the Philippines to show solidarity to the movements there. And I've also been instrumental in working against the austerity budgets that have been passed in the U.S., specifically the student struggle against tuition increases and cutbacks at public universities. Mm-hmm. And as far as, you know, NATO, I had been involved with the International Action Center for a while, and so we were one of the organizations that are part of the United Anti-War Coalition, which a lot of members actually participated in forming the coalition that was working against the NATO summit back when it was NATO and G8. They were going to have their meetings back-to-back in Chicago. So we had been instrumental in building those protests, and I was one of the persons who traveled from New York to actually go and participate in the protest that happened last week, or this weekend. Yeah.
Excellent. But what were your impressions overall about the summit in Chicago? What went down? How did it go down? And just a little bit of information like that. Can you fill us in on your impressions?
Sure. Well, the one thing that we saw is the massive police presence that was mobilized for the streets of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not too much of a surprise because Chicago has one of the largest police departments in the country. But the fact that they called on, you know, they had the Federal Protective Service and they had police agencies from around the Chicago area, you know, as well as Illinois State Patrol, and they were in full riot gear. And you had, you know, the Homeland Security that was there as well, that was coordinating the police response to the protest. And they had been posturing aggressively, you know, months and months before the protests actually took place, and basically scaring people and making them believe. It wasn't violence from the protest that scared people. It was the potential violence from the police that actually scared people from not wanting to participate. And, you know, 3 days before the protest actually happened, you know, on cue, they arrest, you know, they storm someone's house, arrest nine people, two of whom were probably snitches, and they charged three of them who had a beer-making machine with possessing weapons of some type of destruction that could make Molotov cocktails. And along with that, you know, during the protests themselves, they would corral in protesters and begin attacking them. And they were interviewing the police chief throughout the, you know, the protests, you know, about what was going on. And there were all these lies about people carrying fake blood and smearing it on themselves when the police were holding the batons in their hand, big, thick sticks in their hand, you know, smashing them against their legs, you know, with their full body riot suits, just intimidating protesters. And they got to actually unleash the fury of these cops numerous times, and people got very seriously injured by it. But with all of that, there still were 15 to 20,000 people that came out in the streets against this NATO summit and against what it actually means for the rest of the people of the world, especially the oppressed and third world countries. So that's a big accomplishment, you know, that the fear wasn't such that it, you know, made the, you know, it drove people away from actually wanting to participate. It was a fairly large, very militant march. It included people from throughout the community of Chicago, but from also all, you know, all around the country and around the world, actually.
Solomon, you have a question for Larry?
Yeah, I do. Larry, I also wanted to chime in on what you said before, Naveed. You bring up a good point. It would have been nice to, you know, see more of the folks that you know, were there protesting Libya. But, you know, as with, like, brothers like Larry Hale and a lot of other folks that were there, we have to remember that some of those folks that were out there protesting in Chicago against NATO were, in fact, also protesting NATO's involvement and the U.S.'s involvement in the bombing and destruction of Libya. And so, Larry, I wanted to ask you if you can give us a brief historical background of NATO. How did NATO come about? Because we were talking about before you came on, a lot of folks don't know, you know, the origins of NATO. How did NATO come about, and, you know, why, and what is their function that they play now today in the world?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, NATO was a response to, more than anything, you know, the Soviet Union. And, you know, it was sort of a buffer, and actually it was an aggressive posturing against, you know, the threat of communism in Europe after the end of the Second World War. And I think it's, you know, it's important for people to realize that what really broke the back of Hitler's armies of the fascist threat in Europe was the Soviet Union. And the U.S. had held off, a Western front because they wanted to weaken the Soviet Union. And it was the Soviet Union that held back, specifically in Stalingrad, they were the first to actually march into Berlin. And so I think NATO was in response to that, and in response to that threat. And, you know, now as it has grown in the so-called red threat, as they see it, doesn't exist, you know, as it used to exist because of, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union and the overturning of the socialist governments in the Soviet camp, I mean, in the Eastern Europe, of which NATO actually aggressively participated in, even occupying the former Yugoslavia and supporting these so-called color revolutions, which were really rightist overturning of, you know, what was left of the socialist infrastructure in these countries. They call it the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, but really, so if you're to think geographically, you know, about what they're talking about, what business does it have actually moving outside of that now into Africa and into the Middle East? And the reason why it is because what it really represents is the dictates and the desires and wants of the banking and corporate interests of the imperialist world, being the U.S. and the other imperialist European nations, and they bring along a lot of junior partners to, you know, to go along with their endeavors. But it's really all about U.S. imperialism and Western world imperialism in general, conquering the world and stealing the resources. And that was really what Libya was about the resources. You know, the oil and the natural gas that exists underneath the feet of people, under the feet of the Libyan people, but also about the whole history of the support of liberation struggles around the world from the Gaddafi government.
We have to go to a quick break right now, but we'll be right back in a couple of minutes, and we'll pick up right where we left off with our guest Larry Hales talking about NATO and the NATO summit. You're listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WPWC with myself, Naveed Nasser, and my co-host Solomon Kamishong. Right back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to WPWC We Act Radio, 1480 AM, weactradio.com.
Hi, my name is Mark Levine. I host the Inside Scoop on Washington every Sunday from noon to 3 p.m. on We Act Radio. I've been hosting the Inside Scoop since 2003 when I quit my job as a congressional attorney. I began on a suburban radio station in Northern Virginia. Since then, I've been syndicated nationwide. I've been on XM Sirius Radio. I regularly appear on the Bill O'Reilly Show, and I take down Sean Hannity. He says I give him a headache. So I don't just take apart the right wing. I bring them on my show. I give the debates that you want to hear when you argue with your colleagues. You know, the water cooler at the family dinner table, those benighted conservatives that, let's face it, we all have as our family and friends. So check out the Inside Scoop. We deal with everything, economics, law, politics. Sometimes we even have Nancy Skinner on, and she makes me talk about Kim Kardashian. But I don't like that. So we have a well-balanced meal of radio for you. Check out the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, every Sunday, noon to 3 p.m., right here on We Act Radio.
Come to the annual June Fair, a free family and community health expo event sponsored by the HSC Pediatric Center on Saturday, June 9th, from 10 a.m. till 4 p.m. The event includes free health screenings, Zumba, yoga, and jazzercise demonstrations, community resources, healthy cooking demonstrations, food distribution, children's amusement, and developmental screening. The fair will be held at the Michigan Avenue Park, located across from the HSC Pediatric Center at 1731 Bunker Hill Road Northeast, Washington, D.C., 2017. For more information, call 202-580-6485. We hope to see you on June 9th.
And we're back here on Your World News with myself, Naveed Nasser, my co-host, Solomon Kamishong, and our guest, Larry Hales, talking about NATO and about the recent NATO summit in Chicago. So picking up where we left off, Larry, one thing I wanted to mention, and Solomon brought it up, was that, in fact, you and other folks who were at the summit did partake in protests and demonstrations against NATO and even report backs and teach-ins and things like that. And that's absolutely true. I mean, you mentioned International Action Center. And I know that they were among the exceptions to the rule with regards to the U.S. left when it came to that issue. So the thing that I do want to talk about a little bit, at least, is how much of the protests were focusing on specific targets, specific present-day targets of NATO, in terms of, like, hands-off, in terms of, like, no intervention, no war, things like that. Let's say, you know, Syria, Iran. Things of that nature. How much of the protests were focused on that, or was it just about like the broader, not specific context of NATO?
I think a lot of it was the broader, not specific context. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there has been a struggle in the anti-war movement about what it actually means to be anti-war,
mm-hmm.
and supporting the self-determination of a nation against foreign threats and what these foreign threats actually mean. And I think that one thing that needs to be understood in the anti-war movement is that the primary contradiction in the world today is between the oppressed world and the imperialist world. And I don't think people necessarily get that. And so they sometimes develop an incorrect analysis about, you know, what's actually happening in Iran and Syria. And it's unfortunate. I mean, it happened with Yugoslavia as well.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's a struggle that's had within, you know, when you go to these demonstrations. I marched with the International League of People Struggle contingent that the IAC is part of. You know, we raise the banner of these struggles, and we don't leave them behind because it's an important part of the political discourse that has to happen within the framework of these major demonstrations.
Hmm.
So we constantly push that in trying to develop people's understanding of the targets of this military political alliance of NATO. So, you know, but unfortunately, as a whole, I can't, you know, it'd be dishonest if I said the protest sort of took this up and understood it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Except, you know.
Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it's something that a lot of us have been noticing, not just in recent years. You mentioned Yugoslavia, and that was one of the formative, radicalizing events for me back in the 90s. And so it's always there in not just in the back of my mind, in the forefront of my mind, how these things work, the demonization campaigns that pave the way for the bombs and the missiles and the whatever group of Contras is selected as the freedom fighters du jour. Yeah, and it's the same formula applied over and over again, and every time it happens, it feels like we're back at square one, trying to discount or combat the exact same propaganda, trying to lay a counter-narrative to the exact same formula that's being applied in nation after nation after nation. And it's speaking personally, it's frustrating and it's maddening, and it's I don't know how to combat it. And I know it can't be done individually, just myself or just like one, you know, other people that I know. So there has to be some sort of like mass movement. There has to be some sort of I don't know, educational effort or something directed at elements of the left, who large segments of the left, I should say, not just elements of the left, who should know better, who should know, for example, what black propaganda is, what disinformation is, what the inevitable result of these demonization campaigns are, what solidarity means, what self-determination means. And it just seems like there's no, that isn't even on the table. There's just these vague amorphous concepts of freedom, democracy, democratic socialism, and then there's, you know, the standard, what I call privileged first world left view of pox on both your houses. In other words, even as the government that you're living under, that your taxes go to fund in their efforts at regime change operations around the globe, even as these operations are being carried out, you're saying, I'm sitting on a sideline and I'm hurling stones at both of you. In effect, what you're doing is you're ceding the playing field to the strongest player, and you're more or less condoning the actions of your government. At least that's how I see it. Solomon?
Yeah, I see it much of the same way, and we've been having this conversation, which, you know, dates back to last year, 2011, where, you know, so many so-called progressives, I like the way you framed that, Larry, what it really means to be, what does it really mean to be anti-war? And so some folks who have been wearing the mantle of progressives, I don't even see them as such anymore, because they're not anti-war. They see war as an acceptable measure in places like Libya, and did so. Larry, I wanted to ask you, can you draw connections between NATO and that of finance capital or capitalism, you know, in a much broader sense? Like, how do you see NATO in connection to capitalism and its role in terms of protecting finance capital, capitalism in general, as we see it, in the world today?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, I think that it's, you know, the fact that the people who guide know, the decisions of NATO are really centered in the U.S., and that we can expect that, you know, I mean, it's no small thing. I mean, they have conferences all the time, but it's no small thing that they have a conference here in Chicago, you know, in the context of a continuing economic crisis, actually a crisis of the system, not really just, not even just an economic crisis, it's actually a fundamental crisis of the capitalist system, and that we can expect that, you know, a military alliance like this will become even more aggressive as it seeks to try and extricate itself from, you know, this crisis by more aggressive measures and targeting countries around the world so they can, you know, it's like the world sort of is dividing even more along the anti-imperialist line and the most powerful imperialist nations in the world. And the way that they can see themselves free from it is that they can forcibly open markets and steal the resources from aggressively from these countries. And they can upset the political balance of areas, because Syria, it's a lot about the political balance of that particular area, not that they don't have any resources. So I would expect, and actually we should look at Greece. We should pay a whole lot of attention to what's actually happening in Greece and what's going to happen with these elections in the parliament in Greece and what that actually means. If the left coalition is actually going to buck the trend and go against the austerity measures, what, you know, what is NATO actually going to do in response to that? I mean, there's a real threat, you know, right now in Greece, and the role that NATO is actually going to play depending on what happens in the elections. You know, but there's also, you know, China and, you know, posturing against China and other parts of the world too. So I think people have to begin to see it in the light of it being an alliance that really is for the banks and financial institutions. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be used even more, you know, in light of this crisis. You know, I think that, you know, I was going to say before regarding, you know, regarding people's, the progressive but also the ultra-left position on the rest of the world. And it's funny because sometimes people want to pretend as if this is the 60s. And when they look at the world and they say, oh, well, this person was, you know, Gaddafi was this in 1959, but now he's this. It's like, well, political development is dialectical, you know, and the struggle is dialectical. So if we go through a whole period of attack and retreat, you know, of the left, then situation changes for people, and there's the collapse of the Soviet Union. There's no longer that buffer. So every government sort of shifts and changes based off of the conditions, the economic and political conditions that prevail around the world. Mm-hmm. So no, a person's not going to look the same like they did in 1969. That's ridiculous. But they always say that. Ultra-left always say that, and it justifies them, you know, having this weak, really just pro-imperialist stance regarding these oppressed nations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right. There's a degree of purity that's demanded from the left in the U.S., by and large, noble and notable exceptions aside, including the IAC, of a lot of these oppressed countries and the leadership of these countries. Those demands are never placed within any sort of context whatsoever. And, yeah, history is completely erased. Geopolitical context of the present day is completely erased. Whatever enemies the particular state has and what actions it is enacting against it, that's completely erased. It's just the same words, again, devoid of any context, the same words repeated over and over again like a mantra, democracy, freedom, and you know, things along that vein. It's unfortunate, and it is sad, but it's the reality that we have to deal with right now. Larry, I'm kind of sad that we only had a brief moment here to talk with you, and it would be great to have you back on the show as a guest in the very near future to continue to expound on this topic. I'm glad that you were here with us, but, you know, we just had like a very short, narrow window of opportunity here. So hopefully in the not-so-distant future, we're going to have you back here on Your World News as a guest. It's been a pleasure having you here with us and giving us your reflections and your what you took away from the NATO summit, and also talking about NATO within the broader context of imperialism and world events in the present day. But Yeah, Solomon, I'm glad that we had Larry on today per your suggestion. And, yeah, we will have him back as soon as possible, I promise. But in the meantime, we need to go to a quick break. And my name is Naveed Nasser. My co-host is Solomon Kamishong. You're listening to Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio, WPWC. We'll be right back.
You're listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
Hey, it's your boy, Richard Fowler. Catch my show every Friday nights from 8 to 10, only on WEAC Radio. It's time that people understand that they need to inform themselves, empower themselves, and get their voice back. That's the only way we can create real change in this country, if we unite together, and that's what we do every Friday night. We hope you can join the movement with us.
Hi, I'm Curtis. And I'm so glad that I've got my own, you know, so glad that I can see. I've got a natural hide. The man can't put no thing on me, and he can't put no thing on you either. Keep your nose clean. Don't be no junkie. Remember, Freddy's dead.
Local station WLS broadcasts a radio host who personally attacked a young woman just because he disagreed with her. She told elected officials about her classmates who rely on prescription birth control for their health. The host lopped 46 personal attacks at her.
She's having so much sex, it's amazing she can still walk. She's having so much sex, she's going broke buying contraceptives and wants us to buy them. It makes her a slut, right? Makes her a prostitute. She wants to be paid to have sex.
Pick up the phone and tell WLS we don't talk about women like that in Chicago. They should be ashamed. You can reach WLS at 312-984-0890. That's 312-984-0890. Once again, call 312-984-0890 right now and tell WLS there's no place for this kind of indecency to women in Chicago. This community service announcement was paid for by Media Matters for America.
You're listening to WEAC Radio, WPWC, 1480 AM. Visit us online at WEACradio.com.
We're back here on Your World News. My name is Naveed Nasser, and with me is my co-host Solomon Kamishong. Also with us is our second guest for the hour, Drew Franklin. Drew, are you there? Drew?
Hello? Drew, can you hear us?
Can you hear us?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, excellent. All right, excellent. So, Drew, what we're going to be talking about this 25 minutes that we have left here is the Fajol brothers. And can you give us a little bit of background on what's been going on, the campaign against them, why there's even a campaign against them, who they are, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so for those that don't know, the Fajol brothers are now a fleet of food trucks that have been around since 2009 that sell Indian, Ethiopian, and Thai food. And each truck has a theme based on the food that they're selling. So the Indian truck is Merlindia, and they dress up basically in Orientalist clown costumes. They wear turbans and fake mustaches and play Punjabi music and do weird dances. And then the Ethiopian truck is called Benethiopia. Balatai is the Thai truck. And I've been aware of them for a few months now because some friends of mine who are South Asian were really upset and offended by their whole gimmick, and had actually confronted them a number of times very respectfully and calmly, and just try to call them out. And they were shut down. They were rudely dismissed. One friend was told to chill out. And it got to the point where they didn't want to say anything anymore. They didn't see any point. So I got angry myself about the whole thing, and I proposed that I just write an open letter. My friends encouraged me to do so. The letter ended up turning out pretty angry and inflammatory. So I just put it on Facebook, not really. I tagged the Joel Brothers business, hoping they'd see it, but I didn't know who all would see it. But it ended up being passed around, and it got picked up. Somebody from the Huffington Post saw it, and they contacted me. They made a story, it became a news story. That blew up. And in that news story on the Huffington Post, Justin Vitarello, the owner of the Joel Brothers, said, you know, again, was really dismissive of the charges and said some pretty ignorant things, like, you know, he said it was all fantasy, which we thought was disingenuous, because obviously he's selling food from actual cultures that he's calling fantasy. He was just dismissive, and so that led to Arturo starting a petition, because he said that Justin said no more than five people had said anything, so it's not a problem. And just to make the point that more than five people have a problem with it, said this petition that ended up gathering more than 1,000 signatures in under a week, became this kind of local media story, and has been just a huge discussion in the city.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned the Huffington Post piece. I know that there's been other local media and even broader national media like Huffington Post,
right,
the story has come to the attention of, and they've covered it. So can you tell me in general, like what sort of, what the media out there is making of this, of the Fajol brothers themselves, or the campaign against them, what sort of feedback you've gotten in general, positive or negative, that sort of thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's been really interesting seeing how the media has kind of shaped the narrative around this. I suppose the pretense of objectivity is what they're promoting here, but they really, we had a clearly articulated and pretty radical message about how this is Orientalist and how that relates to, you know, historically relates to colonialism and, you know, things like that. And none of that made it into the paper, which has always been my experience with mainstream media, is that usually the least salient point you make, the least remarkable thing you say, or the dumbest thing you say finds its way to the paper. Mm-hmm. But the media's kind of shaped it as like a very subjective, like, are they racist or are they not, controversy, the fact is that a lot of people have been speaking out about this for a while, and the response has been just like, especially, I guess, on the internet, it's just people came out of the woodworks defending this business and hitting us with the same arguments that I'm used to hearing, like, the PC police are just trying to spoil our fun, which, you know, to me just shows that what they find fun is racism. So if that's fun to you, then yeah, I'm here to spoil your fun. You know, arguments like, oh, they're, you know, it's a carnival, and right there they're erasing some of the racist history of even carnivals, or, you know, it's fantasy, or they're honoring those cultures, all kinds of stuff, and nobody wants to actually talk critically about the politics of race and racism in this city and the implications of it and just the historical context of it. So it's kind of disheartening to hear how many people have responded really vociferously in defense of this business. But I think that, I mean, the petition speaks for itself. I think there are a lot of people who aren't getting as much airtime, so to speak, who get it and who understand that this is offensive and want to speak out. And that's why this thing has been going on as long as it has.
Yeah, this is Solomon. I have a question for you, because you brought up the point, Ben, and I definitely also see this as very, 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 very racist. And you spoke about spoiling their fun, and you know, one of the things I think of in terms of really spoiling their fun is to have a mass boycott of this, and I think that before that boycott, you're doing exactly what you have to do, and that's raise consciousness, raise awareness about you know, about this this food truck, the Fajul Brothers, and given a deeper context in terms of why, you know, it is racist, why it should be seen racist. How do you plan on continuing to move this forward, and how can folks support this campaign, this necessary campaign? Because I think that's the only way. Unfortunately, some folks, you know, their moral barometer is very, very low, and they don't have a good gauge in terms of, you know, of what should be seen as racist, what should be seen as inappropriate at the extreme least. So the only way to, like, kind of wake these folks up is to hit them where it counts, and that's in their pocketbooks. And so I wanted to get your thoughts about a boycott and how to try to get more widespread support for this initiative.
Yeah, in terms of a boycott, I mean, you know, people who were already had a problem with this, you know, the argument is if you don't like it, don't eat there. Well, I don't think most of us who have had a problem with this are eating there. Obviously, that hasn't been enough, and that's why we've had to be really vocal about it recently. And, I mean, I hope that that's kind of awakened some of their customer base, and it'll cause them to think twice about eating there. But the fact is that they continue to have a base of customers who are really either just apathetic or are quite defensive of that company, because I think that a lot of people in the city today share this mindset that allows this to happen.
You're right.
I mean, as we know, DC has really rapid displacement of people of color taking place, and I think that's what and the people that are gentrifying, displacing, are the, you know, mostly who work downtown are the main ones that are supporting this business. So right now there's a petition delivery taking place, I think, as we speak. So there's a public display going on now, which hopefully will escalate the stakes of this. But really, if we want to really attack this problem, then it needs to we need to be intentional about making it bigger than just the Fozil Brothers. You know, this is almost practice in the sense that it's part of a much larger trend that we need to take head on. This trend of white supremacy,
that's right,
allowing people to move in and do this kind of thing.
That's right. And if I can, really quickly, I couldn't agree with you more, because when you look in the larger context of D.C., and D.C. is just a microcosm of America, and you look at right here, this is a city whose football team is one of the most racist names that one can conjure up. But routinely, you know, you have D.C. residents and folks within the DMV that will continue to pay exorbitant, you know, ticket prices to go and support that team, and will buy paraphernalia that has the name, you know, has that name, you know, all over their jerseys and hats and so forth. And so, yeah, there's this acceptance and this excuse making that goes on when you approach folks and tell them that, and they routinely will say, oh, come on, it's tradition, and, you know, and, right. And then you try to, like, reason with them and from a standpoint of logic, saying, well, slavery, you know, was tradition
right.
at one time.
Right.
Jim Crow was tradition, you know, and,
right.
and you know, so I couldn't agree with you more. It's a widespread epidemic in this America, known as Americanism, and white supremacy and institutional racism are littered and riddled through this country.
Yeah.
Drew, if you have a thought, and right now in response to Salman, I'm going to ask you to hold it because we need to go to a quick break, but we'll be right back in a couple of minutes, picking up right where we left off. You're listening to Your World News with Naveed Nasser, my co-host Solomon Kamishong, our guest Drew Franklin. We'll be right back in 2 minutes here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio.
You're listening to WPWC WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, WEACradio.com.
Take Action News with David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, and WEACradio.com.
Well, for me, it's always been, you know, you report the facts. You report like hell, let the chips fall where they may. And the truth ultimately is what's going to sort of help our society and help all of us. I don't think progressives want a thumb on the scale on the facts. They just want the facts down there. You let the facts out, and progressives will tell you, you know, we're going to win 70% of the time. You may quibble with the percentages or whatnot, but I think that's just sort of what progressives are looking for, and I think that's where this all sort of meshes with my interest as a journalist. My interest as a journalist is report the facts. Here's what's going on. Here's what the facts say. Here's what history says. Here are the lessons we know we have learned. And let people draw their own conclusions. And I think what's so unfortunate right now in the world of broadcast media is I do think that a lot of conservative radio, certainly conservative television, they're not interested in facts. And that's ultimately where I think conservative media is going to have its downfall, that Americans are hungry. They're just hungry for basic information, hungry for basic facts. You report like hell, you let the chips fall where they may. I think it's natural for all of us who care, who are passionate about politics, who feel like we have a sense about the difference between right and wrong. I think it's okay to let that be part of your coverage. It's important for all of us as broadcasters and journalists. In this day and age, we have to be authentic. You can't be the person who's up in the ivory tower that comes down and tells people, now you must eat your peas. No, it's all about, we all have personalities, and I think it's being aware sometimes of our own bias, but also being open to the idea that sometimes we're wrong. But we have a dialogue, and we have a passionate dialogue, and we care about this country, we care about this community, and I think that sort of passion is what carries us through.
Hear more from David Schuster, Saturdays from 12 to 3 on Take Action News, on WEAC Radio, 1480 AM, and WEACradio.com.
This is Margaret Flowers.
And I'm Kevin Zeese. Join us every Monday morning, 11 a.m., for Clearing the Fog.
Speaking truth to expose the forces of greed.
Start the week with your eyes open.
The Fog?
The forces of greed that spin news stories for the benefit of the 1%.
Each week, we feature guests who are working to expose these truths and offer real solutions to the current crises we face.
Knowledge is power, and with knowledge, you will be empowered to act to shift the power to the people.
Monday mornings at 11 a.m. on WEACradio.com or 1480.
And we're back here on Your World News here on 1480 AM WEAC Radio WPWC. My name is Naveed Nasser, my co-host Solomon Kamishong, and our guest right now is Drew Franklin. We're talking about the Fajol Brothers food truck, actually a fleet of food trucks, I guess, in D.C. that thinks it's funny for their customers to dress up in all sorts of outlandish ethnic costumes and, you know, play, like Drew said, Punjabi music and basically act a fool and, you know, normalize and make, you know, humorize white supremacy, essentially. And I'm glad that Drew placed it within that context before we went to the break. And picking up where Solomon left off, Solomon was putting forward something right before we went to the break, which is like this fact that, oh, it's just, you know, it's just something that we do. It's like it's tradition, it's culture, whatever. It's whether it comes down to the name of the football team, whether it comes down to, you know, the Confederate flag, slavery. I mean, there's all sorts of things that can fall under the banner of tradition, or this is just how it's been, or this is just how we do things, and it's really just a way to deflect and shift blame and responsibility. And again, part of that whole normalizing racism, normalizing white supremacy, and I feel like I'm editorializing here quite a bit instead of letting Drew talk. Drew, you and Arturo were the ones who started this campaign, and I'm glad that you're on the air with us to talk about this, but how do you feel about putting it within that broader context of, like you said, what's going on in the city, but also white supremacy, and sort of this normalizing of bigotry?
I think it's essential. One of the criticisms that we've gotten about this is people are saying, you know, there are bigger fish to fry. Why are you focusing on a food truck when you've got, you know, a drug war and you've got all kinds of institutional racism and stuff like that? And my response to that, first of all, is, you know, if we can't even hold the local business accountable as a community, then how are we supposed to take on the drug war or something larger like that? How can we expect to be successful in that? And, you know, they all ultimately, again, bringing it to white supremacy is the structural foundation of racism, but the way that it's able to, the way that space is made for that to occur is, like you said, normalized behavior. And the only way to take it on is to challenge that behavior at every step, at every turn, you know, to make sure that people know and understand, people can't be comfortable behaving in this way. And, you know, that's why something like the Redskins can exist. That's why something like, you know, I mean, it's interesting with South Asian cultures. There was the Ashton Kutcher thing recently. Somebody put out a good article in the New York Times about how South Asians are essentially fair game, and you can whereas it's mostly taboo to at least engage in overt racism against blacks. Obviously, there's lots of institutional racism, there's lots of less overt racism that is hugely problematic and takes place all the time. But in terms of like the kind of minstrel performance, you probably couldn't get away with that. You know, attacking blacks in this city or this country. But people just find other cultures and ethnic groups that are fair game, like South Asians and like indigenous people, which, you know, as we know, just in North and South America is pretty much the longest occupation in history. Mm-hmm. This isn't the United States' land to begin with. This isn't white people's land to begin with. And that's stuff that's not even talked about. And that's a struggle that has been enduring for so long. And thanks to you know, movements in the 60s, it might be taboo for blacks, but there's obviously a lot of real radical work that needs to be done now to take on this greater pervasive problem, white supremacy, that manifests in so many ways, and we have to attack them on all fronts.
Mm-hmm. One thing I noticed in response to what's going on is, I know me and you have talked about it, and in our circle it's been talked about, is there's been like sort of like this pushback from at least segments of the South Asian community, which have been like, what are you doing? You're expropriating our culture. You're trying to speak for us, and you know, you're discounting our opinions about this, and we don't think it's racist. And I mean, it is unfortunate, but you know, it needs to be put out there, and it needs to be discussed. And here's what I'm going to put out on the table. And I'm not asking you necessarily to back me on this, Drew, but you know, I'm speaking from personal experience and speaking from being from a community like this. When we talk about the South Asian community and the Middle Eastern community in this area specifically, we're talking about folks by and large who are upper middle class, who have pretty good jobs, who live in fairly high-end neighborhoods, and who think of themselves as sort of like model minorities and people who've made it. You know, we came here legally and we pulled ourselves up by our bootstraps, and you know, we've done things the right way and we've made it. We're part of the social fabric of America, and we're as American as everyone else. And it's almost bad form. And bad form to think of themselves as being victims of anything in any way whatsoever, particularly racism, And it's unfortunate, but I mean, that's a reality. So when people come up and say you've been, when people come up and tell them, like, you know, this is wrong and this community is being victimized, your community is being targeted, and this is racism directed at you, they'll say, no, heck no, we're not victims of discrimination. We're not, nothing is being done to us, you know, and it's a reflection of who they are and their background, that class background that always needs to be put up there front and center is what makes them feel like they're not targets of racism, they're not victims, and in fact they're just as much a American as anyone else. But yeah, Drew, you don't need to necessarily, if you don't want to, you know, wade in that water, you don't necessarily have to agree with me. But
Naveed, well, I want to ask you a question. Naveed, something I saw on your Facebook,
right.
I think last week. What is your, if you could, you know, tell our listeners, what is your take on this this new Sacha Cohen movie, The Dictator, and do you find it to be racist?
Yeah. I haven't actually seen the movie yet. Hey, Nermeen, how's it going? I actually haven't seen the movie yet, but I think from what I've seen, it is incredibly racist. And again, it is annoying and naive, I think, for people to project their own feelings about any particular quote unquote dictator in the Middle East or North Africa onto this movie. I've seen clips from the movie, which include things like jokes about female infanticide, which have absolutely nothing to do with any particular ruler or anything like that. It's a pure racism directed, broadly speaking, at the cultures of the Middle East and North Africa. And it's done by someone who isn't from those cultures, who is not a representative of those cultures, and that is very important. Whether or not people choose to accept that reality or not, that's very important. It's one thing for someone like, what's that South Asian comic's name? Russell, I forget his name, he's from Canada. But, I mean, he's really good, you know, and he does this great, when it comes to South Asian ethnic comedy and also like other kinds of ethnic comedy, he's really great. But it's one thing for him to do it, you know. It will be another thing for some other comic, I don't know, Jeff Foxworthy or who's that guy, the Larry the Cable Guy, someone like that to do something like that. Context is everything. And people, I mean, it's just reality. People need to accept that. That context is everything. Who is doing or saying something matters a lot. And some people should be allowed to say and do certain things. And others, you know, got to realize who they are and what the context of what they're doing is, and they got to, you know, take a step back and check themselves. You know, it's not just, come on, man, lighten up, I'm just having fun. I was like, no, I mean, I'm almost tempted to, you know, curse here. I'm not going to, but, you know, no, it's not just about having fun. Like, look in the mirror, realize who you are, and take a step back and check yourself. You know, it's really as simple as that. And listen, Drew, thank you so much for coming on the air and talking about this with us.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, and we should also have you back on at some point to talk about some of the other stuff that you've been doing. But it's been another great show. I feel Salman, thank you again, and for this opportunity of co-hosting this show with you. I really mean it. It's a privilege being here and doing this, and I can't imagine doing anything else. And you know, this is where it's at, and this is what we need to be doing, combating this narrative that's out there on all fronts. So once again, you've been listening to Your World News. My name is Naveed Nasser. My co-host Salman Kamishong. Our guests today have been Larry Hales and Drew Franklin. You're listening to We Act Radio, 1480 AM, WPWC. We'll be right back next week, same time, same place, Fridays, 11 AM.